This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadam Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now, here is your host for JAMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight continued advances in post-acute and long-term care, national and international research from the October 2019 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association. To lead our review, we are delighted to have JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, back with us again. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Sloan, welcome back to JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you so much, Wayne. It's great to join you again.
Dr. Sloan, I see that the October 2019 issue of JAMDA has a specific theme on lower extremity impairment with several papers and an editorial by you and co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman. I was specifically taken by your discussion on potential reversible causes of lower extremity impairment. But I also understand that this has been a personal interest of yours for some time. Can you reflect with us on how this topic became important to you?
Well, you know, it was really a gradual thing. When I was in residency and fellowship at the University of Miami, I kept seeing articles in the newspaper about older persons who were driving their cars and accidentally hit the accelerator instead of the brake, and they'd plow into a building or drive into the canal. I remember one case where I was working in the emergency department, a 92-year-old man had seen a friend of his in the hospital, and he accidentally hit the accelerator instead of the brake, plowed into the side of the wall of the hospital, and came in. He said his leg just didn't do what he told it to do. And it happened so often in Miami that I started collecting these articles. And that got me really thinking that legs seem to stop doing what they're supposed to do as people get older. A little later, when my mom got into her 90s, her biggest limitation was weakness, pain, and diminished function in her legs, to the point where she spent the last few years mainly in bed or bed to wheelchair, and no one had a good explanation for why this was happening. Every time I come to visit, she would jokingly ask me for a new pair of legs, but in fact, she would love to have had them. A decade later, similar thing happened to my mother-in-law. Both women, in fact, spent their last 5 years cognitively functioning quite well, but in wheelchairs because their legs didn't work. So I got really interested in, as I saw more and more patients, it didn't seem to come together real well. But I was increasingly struck by the number of older persons who use walkers, scooters, and wheelchairs, not just in nursing homes, but in all senior communities. We just accept it as part of aging, it seems. We say it's for safety, or we help them get around, and yet we know that maintaining mobility is so important in preventing a variety of complications, and that using a device can promote weakness and loss of function over time, as well as making it easier for somebody to get around. So I started accumulating statistics, and some of these are in the editorial on October's JAMDA.
Yeah, the title of the editorial, to me, is both powerful and provocative, as it is not inherently intuitive. Lower extremity impairment parallels cognitive impairment as a cause of disability, a call for public awareness. Parallels cognitive impairment. Wow. Tell us about your thoughts behind this.
Happy to do that. Let me start first by explaining what I mean by lower extremity impairment. I think most of our listeners will understand. By that, I mean a syndrome that includes walking problems, lower extremity weakness, joint pain, and increased dependency on assistive devices such as walkers, scooters, and wheelchairs. So the statistics show that 6.4 million Americans regularly use a cane or crutch, 4.9 million regularly use a walker, and 3.1 million regularly use a wheelchair. So I can think of that as kind of mild, moderate, and severe lower extremity impairment. Mm-hmm. And not surprisingly, with increasing disability comes an increased likelihood of residing in assisted living or a nursing home.
Right.
So when we compare the numbers, there are approximately 3.1 million older persons in the U.S. with severe mobility impairment. In other words, they use a wheelchair. And almost the identical number, 3.1 million older persons with moderate or severe cognitive impairment. In other words, we have just as many people with severe lower extremity impairment as with moderate to severe dementia. And when you compare the service needs in terms of RUG scores and reimbursement levels in nursing homes, a person who is confined to a wheelchair actually has a higher RUG score, in other words, needs more minutes of nursing and personal care assistance daily than someone who has moderate or severe cognitive impairment but intact mobility.
I think that many could make the argument that being wheelchair-bound does not necessarily impair productivity and independence. Is it really valid to compare that scenario with someone who has dementia?
I think so. I mean, I do understand that the behavioral manifestations and the need for 24-hour supervision that accompany advanced dementia make its public health impact more devastating than that of practically any other chronic condition that leaves the brain intact. But you know, you could ask, which would you rather have, 5 years of cognitive impairment or 5 years in a wheelchair and not able to get around and dependent on other people? I think people might argue these back and forth because they're both things with devastating consequences.
You know, it's a wonderful editorial. It's really a very, very interesting read. And it also notes a gender imbalance here, with women being particularly affected?
That's true. Data from the U.S. National Health and Aging Trends Study indicate that the proportion of men using a cane, walker, wheelchair, or motorized scooter rises from 10% at ages 65 to 69 to nearly 60% by age 90. But among women, the proportion is even higher, going up to 75% by age 90. And it seems that women have a longer period of disability, typically, than men.
It's surprising data, in a way, even for a geriatrician. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction to this segment, JAMDA shares with us research from all over the world. And one of the original research articles from the October 2019 issue helps reinforce this U.S. data, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. This article reports findings from an international mobility and aging study in which slightly over 2,000 older adults were enrolled at ages 65 to 74 and then followed up for multiple years. These authors identified three trajectories of lower extremity function: rapid functional decline, gradual functional decline, and stable high function. They found that more women more often suffered functional decline, and that functional decline was related not just to chronic illness, but also to such things as obesity and what they called feminine gender stereotypes.
Which is interesting, especially in this time and age. So what did the authors mean by feminine gender stereotypes?
Well, this was not a very satisfying part of the article because they didn't really explain this at all. But other research has shown that in certain cultures, older women generally stay in the home, and after the children leave, they spend increasing time sitting, often doing seated activities or watching television. And for example, the dad might go out and play golf in retirement, but mom might watch TV. I realize this applies less to U.S. society, but remember, this was an international study, and these gender roles are thankfully changing, but not fast enough for these statistics. And then, as you know, sedentary behavior is related to development of obesity and, of course, decreased muscle strength, muscle mass, and muscle performance over time. In fact, we have another article in October JAMDA that deals with that topic. In it, another international group of researchers describes the results of a meta-analysis of seven longitudinal studies looking at mortality and physical activity. They found that sedentary behavior, and particularly television viewing time, was associated with an increase in mortality. They hypothesized that it might be on the basis of stimulating the production of inflammatory markers, such as C-reactive protein. But, you know, they also noted that getting up and doing something physical periodically may help counteract these effects. But a knowledge of the interrelationships between sedentary activity, physical activity, and sleep are not well understood.
So let's talk about what this means clinically. So what are the actionable steps or take-home lessons that you all gleaned from these articles?
Well, you could say that at least we're confused at a higher level. I can't help believing that there have been disease factors as well involved in patients and family I've observed who lost lower extremity function. I think there's a high-level unappreciation of small vessel CNS disease. And of course, there are musculoskeletal issues such as arthritis, in which pain often leads to inactivity. Though we now know that activity often makes pain better and not worse if we get just, you know, if we can just get people to do it. So it's pretty complicated because we know some patients have a variety of things and they all seem to add together, but for some reason it's like the lower extremity is the outer reaches of the empire. And they tend to be more susceptible to many factors. On a societal level, we have to think about whether we can make some changes that will help forestall this lower extremity impairment that comes because of things like inactivity and obesity and other things that we can do something about. And let's face it, we drive everywhere. Few people take the stairs. You know, our communities are really designed for walking. And as people get older, there's muscle weakness, obesity, sedentary behavior, over-reliance on devices such as scooters. Each of these issues can be modified with preventive behavior, but it really is going to take changes in our society. So as physicians, I think we can and should champion for change, but that change is going to require changes in societal values.
We will return to our interview after this brief message from Avadam, the creators of TheraWorks. What are you missing to drive better outcomes for recurrent UTI patients, from mounting antibiotic-resistant concerns to unproven over-the-counter remedies? Your options for preventing urinary tract infections in post-acute care facilities have been limited until now. Safe for a variety of urogenital uses and won't contribute to resistance, the TheraWorks Protect UPAC is the safe, clinically proven, convenient hygiene solution you've been missing. To learn more about how the UPAC can become part of your UTI prevention protocols, visit seewhatsmissing.com.
So let's talk about some other research that's been highlighted in the October issue of JAMDA. There's a paper on the impact of long-term care ombudsmen, who we kind of have a certain thought about and how they advocate for residents or can be involved in many different ways. This one paper talks about some interesting conclusions that we may not be aware of, those of us who work in the trenches, or would not expect. Do you agree?
I very much agree. Yes, this study looked at nearly 100,000 nursing home surveys from nearly 15,000 nursing homes, trying to see whether, and first of all, they identified whether an ombudsman was present at the survey, and if so, whether that was associated with any specific survey findings. What they found was that having an ombudsman there was associated with a 3-6% increase in citations, with the biggest increase in citations around quality of life and administrative deficiencies. They also found that ombudsmen tended to accompany survey teams when they were going to facilities with low quality ratings. And I have to say, you know, I'm always concerned that the low-quality facilities always get hit with the worst stuff, and it makes it harder for them to recuperate if they're really trying to. And so I question, you know, whether having this additional factor as part of the survey in some homes and not others is fair, and whether ombudsmen always act as impartial mediators, which, according to the authors, is what they should be doing. We like ombudsmen, and we work with them, and we really appreciate the fact that they are often on the first line of monitoring. But on the other hand, we don't want to have any unanticipated consequences or unexpected consequences as well.
This is what I like about JAMDA, that it brings to us articles and considerations that we may not have thought of, but now we really need to think about. But I have to tell you, in the time we have left, I want to discuss one more paper that was interesting. It had to do with hospital care, and it involved sleep questionnaires. Tell us about this one.
This was done by some anesthesiologists and surgeons in hospitals. And what they had found was that after surgery, some people end up having codes called on them because they have respiratory difficulties, you know, when they're coming out of anesthesia. And they learned that these people often had undetected obstructive sleep apnea. And so they did a study where they, during the preoperative period, they administered these questionnaires for obstructive sleep apnea to the people. And what they found was there was a strong correlation between a positive score on these questionnaires and then having a problem after surgery. So they're really advocating that it becomes standard to do a really relatively simple obstructive sleep apnea questionnaire. And that would, if it's positive, then that would alert the anesthesia team to really be prepared to be particularly assertive and aggressive after surgery to prevent respiratory distress or, you know, or apnea or other complications that would occur otherwise. I found it really interesting because, you know, we don't think about often what's happening in and after surgery, but then as geriatricians, we're often called upon to opine beforehand, and this might be something we'd think about.
What's interesting for me in this paper is that we've all encountered patients who have had a specific manifestation, and it turns out to be due to obstructive sleep apnea. Me personally was on depression. And once the sleep apnea was addressed, things were improved. So now I have it included in every one of my geriatric assessments, some questions regarding sleep, looking for sleep apnea. So this paper was great and appropriate clinically. Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look. Dr. Sloan, thank you for spending your time with JAMDA on the go, and we look forward to ongoing reviews from JAMDA issues.
Thank you, Wayne. My pleasure as well.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com and www.jamda.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA on the go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadam Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.